Welcome to the Splash Page Podcast, Episode 1. This is Tim Callahan. I'm joined today, as always, by Chad Nevitt, and we'll talk about comic books and a little bit more. This is our first episode, and we had a lot of audio problems, and we lost a lot of our recording. So what we have is a bunch of pasted together fragments of genius.
So we talked about Bendis, we talked about Joe the Barbarian, that no one will ever hear our thoughts on.
That's true, yes.
What else did you get this week that maybe you think I didn't get?
I'm assuming you probably didn't get Gravel or Anna Mercury.
I didn't, but I did buy No Heroes, the trade paperback.
Oh, you did buy No Hero.
Yeah, No Hero. Yeah, right. I bought that this week, which I haven't read. I just picked it up. So what should I know about Anna Mercury? Is that any good, the first series?
It's the good sort of just poppy action, adventure, Warren Ellis kind of thing. Where the first series was surprising in that at the end of the third issue, it felt like it could have ended there in that typical Warren Ellis three-issue miniseries, action miniseries kind of way. And then he had two more issues, and that was kind of surprising. They were good, and they followed up on some logical points of the story, but I remember at the time when the third issue kind of ended, I was like, wait, there's two more issues? Because it very much followed the sort of structure I thought of Red and Reload and the Wildstorm three-issue miniseries that he did years ago.
And then the final two issues, did they feel like epilogues after that, or did they work in the structure?
They worked, oddly. It's just at the time where I think he could have actually stopped there, and I don't think I would have complained either. It was... I haven't gone back and reread the series as a whole, but yeah, they didn't feel like epilogues, but they also didn't feel essential once the third issue came out.
See, my thing with Warren Ellis, and obviously we talked about this and we did the whole big debate, and I was in the position of kind of defending Geoff Johns against Warren Ellis, which was a ridiculous position to be in, but that was the position I took. The thing about Warren Ellis is that with his Avatar work, my local shop doesn't get the Avatar stuff at all. So
really?
I could pre-order, but I hate pre-ordering stuff. I just like to get what's there, and I could, I guess, direct him to order more things specifically for me. But the only time I ever see his Avatar stuff is when I go to conventions, and then I never feel like buying a whole bunch of Avatar stuff at conventions. You know, it doesn't seem like I want to lug this big backpack full of Avatar trades around. So with the Warren Ellis Avatar stuff, what do you think are the really key things that I should check out besides No Hero, which I just picked up?
You got Black Summer?
I don't have anything, I don't think.
Black Summer, just because that starts the sort of thematic trilogy that No Hero is the second part of. They don't really, like, the plots don't sync up. They're just thematically, like, that Super God is doing the last part, where I think Ellis said Black Summer was about superhumans who were too human. The No Heroes about superhumans who are inhuman, and Super God is about superhumans who aren't human at all.
Okay. Yeah, I have actually seen, because the store I went to this week that I was able to pick up No Hero from, they had Super God, but I'm not going to pick up just floppies of Super God. I'll wait for the trade on that and then get the whole trilogy in trade and reflect on the whole thing. And I'm sure I'll get a column out of it, which is always nice.
Yeah, this goes back years when I first started reading Warren Ellis, and he started with Strange Kiss, which began the William Gravel combat magician stories.
Right.
Which was followed up with Stranger Kisses, and the Four Strange Killing miniseries now has the Gravel ongoing. I really like that, but I think I've mentioned that on my blog a few times, where it's one of those books that I always look forward to, always enjoy, but it's kind of like the Bendis stuff in the sense that it's always consistently at like that 3.5 level. Always consistently good, very good, but very rarely jumps above that either.
Yeah, I find that with a lot of the Garth Ennis stuff for me. And I've dropped the Boys at this point. I know,
really?
I found the Boys to be just, I don't know. It's not even that it's so relentless or over the top. It just, to me, it still isn't about anything. It's just a series of things that are happening, and I really don't care. And I just have finally realized when I had to cut back because I couldn't keep buying all the stuff I was buying. I said, that's one of the things I just don't care about. And since I dropped it a couple months ago, I haven't had any interest in picking it back up again. And that's how I feel about most of the Ennis books. It's like, yep. And same thing with the War Stories books or the Battlefields books. I mean, you know, they're okay. And when I have sampled them for CBR reviews, they're fine. But, like, I'm not compelled to buy anymore.
I agree with the war books. The Boys, I think that lazy structure is purposeful in the sense that he's dealing with sort of a superhero title. So at least for the first half of the run, it's been kind of purposeful in the sense these people are together. So every story arc, they encounter something that may not have to do with anything like regular superheroes, as opposed to previous stuff like Reacher, where there very much was a clear plot line throughout the entire thing. It may have deviated from time to time, but you knew where it was going towards. Whereas with the Boys, I think he's been a bit more loose on purpose.
I guess what I liked more about the Preacher structure was that he had these mini arcs within larger arcs, and so he would have, you know, he'd have the road trip, but then he had him as the sheriff, and then he had the larger overarching plot with the big bad guys. And I liked the way things were kind of nestled together, and I liked the little individual conflicts within those larger pictures. And with the Boys, it just feels more episodic, and I don't really get a sense of the overall structure as much. It seems like it's just him making jokes about superheroes, and yeah, I guess he's developing his characters a little bit, but I just don't see the structure, I guess.
I can see the structure. It's going to lead to the conflict is really the Boys versus the 7/Vought American. Like, that's pretty obvious, but I do agree with the character development. This has been, as much as I think Huey's the only one who's really, Butcher's been hinted at, but Huey's the only one that really has been focused on as far as a character goes. And
yeah, at all.
And I find, yeah, that is odd for a Garth Ennis book, because usually he's very good at having a, not a big cast, but at least a like a small cast of five people that are all very well developed, and here it seems to be Huey's well developed, possibly Annie, his secretly superpowered girlfriend who's with the Seven.
Right.
She's pretty developed. Everybody else has been not as much, even with the origins that we just got out of Mother's Milk and the Frenchman and the female, like, that didn't necessarily shed a lot of their character. I think for Mother's Milk, but not for the other two as much.
And that is interesting. I mean, it's, you know, it's been, that series has been going on for half a decade, and there's not a lot about the characters that you can really say. They're very still caricatures in a lot of ways.
I think that kind of works. Like, I think we know how the female began, but I don't think knowing more would actually benefit that character. I think she kind of benefits from being mute, mysterious, violent. Like, I don't think she needs anything else.
So where do you find the interesting angle on that series then? Is it, if it's not the characters, and the art is fine, but it's, the art's not anything that's astonishing in any way. So what's the appeal for you about that series?
Well, I disagree with the art, at least when it comes to Derek Robertson, but I'm a bit of a sucker for him. But I also think Ennis is writing very much towards his strengths of that sort of grotesque, over-the-top expressions and violence and stuff like that Robertson does very well. I do, honestly, I like the way it makes fun of superheroes a lot of the time. Not always. I find Ennis can push it a bit too far. Herogasm was a case of that was 3 or 4 issues spread out over 6.
Yeah.
But most of the time, I kind of like that he's done each arc where he picks on a different superhero group. I'm okay with that. I don't find the joke gets old because, again, he's directing at specific tropes of each team and focusing on what makes those teams unique and picking out the jokes there. Or the, I think it was the 3rd arc where they did the Batman analog that was humping everything and the gay Nightwing.
Yeah.
Where he was just totally picking apart Judd Winnick writing.
Yeah.
And I loved that.
I really enjoyed that stuff, too. I enjoyed a lot. Basically, the first 25 issues or so I really liked. But then, for me, it just started to kind of fall apart. It became more of the same, and I lost interest.
Yeah, so that's probably in the We Gotta Go Now story with the X-Men.
Yeah, I kind of liked how that arc ended, but I had lost interest during that arc.
Yeah, and that one went on a little bit long.
And then when it ended, I was like, oh, that's a pretty good ending. And then the next couple issues seemed to be some slow moving stuff, and I just said, okay, that's time to drop it. And it's just one of those things that just got the axe because it wasn't holding my interest the way other stuff was. Although something like Amazing Spider-Man, I don't think Amazing Spider-Man is groundbreaking or anything, but I keep going back to it. I drop Amazing Spider-Man, and I remember last year when I talked about Amazing Spider-Man in a blog post about a year ago, I talked about how I really liked the thrice monthly schedule because it's great for serialized comics. It like keeps the momentum going. But over the summer when I was moving into a new house, I got 2 months behind, and so 6 issues behind, I didn't really feel like getting caught up, and I just dropped it because of that. But I keep finding myself getting pulled back into Amazing Spider-Man because it's always got, well, recently, it's got some phenomenal artists on it, and it's got that fun little narrative hook. So series like that, I can drift away from and then get suckered back into. But with The Boys, I haven't felt compelled to go back into it yet.
Well, that's harder to do because, again, this is more of a whole narrative where if you miss a chunk of it, you're going to be missing out on part of the bigger story. Whereas Amazing Spider-Man, you can really drift in and out, and you may not be missing much at all.
No, you really don't. It's not hard to jump back into Amazing Spider-Man. And really what I told myself with that is, well, I'm just going to buy it if I really like the artist. But the past 2 months, there's been one fantastic artist after another. I mean, starting with Eric Kennedy's book with issue 611, basically all the way through, Javier Pulido and Marcos Martin. I mean, these are some fantastic artists, and I just can't resist. I see a Geoff Johns comic as not one that's going to make me think deeply about anything at all. It's not going to make me question anything. It's not going to make me think differently about comic books or superheroes or any of that. It's just a really good ride that does what I want comics to do, but they're ephemeral. They don't really linger in my mind after I read them. I just enjoy the experience. And when I review his comics, I try to capture that feeling that, yeah, this is an enjoyable comic for me. But it seems like that to you is off-putting. That's the things that I like are the very things that you tend to do not like as much.
Partly. I think it could be chalked up to also the fact that it seems the characters he wants to get those high moments out of, I not only don't care about, I actually kind of dislike. Like
Like who?
Hal Jordan, I actively dislike that
Yeah,
character.
okay, why do you hate Hal Jordan? What is your hatred of Hal Jordan based on?
I think it's partly based on his fans, which isn't a fair thing to say, but again, if you look at me coming, like, I think the only comic that I can say I ever bought and read with Hal Jordan when he was an actual Green Lantern was that Return of the Superman stuff where he tied in at the end with the destruction of Coast City.
Okay.
Hal Jordan, as far as I'm concerned, is the guy who had a city destroyed, went nuts, and Kyle Rayner came in and became Green Lantern.
So is it a generational thing where you just feel like he was on his way out, and so one of the things you don't like about his fans is the idea that they were saying they're clamoring for his return, and it was like, your time has passed, let him go, and you just think that that whole concept is annoying?
I also, yeah, that's partly it, but also everything that I've ever gone back and seen of him before that, he was just a dull character. He's just a stupid, brainless action guy who's just like, there's nothing he doesn't seem to want to solve with his fists.
Yeah.
And I find that mentality very boring.
So do you think Kyle Rayner was a more inherently interesting character?
I can't say that for sure because my main experience with him was Morrison writing him, so I don't know how well Ron Mars or anybody else handled the character, because I never really read Green Lantern, because that was even a concept that I found off-putting. Just because I think it's one of those things they always hint at, the fact that you have a ring that can basically do anything, and yet you lose fights ever. Why? It's one of
See,
my. It's one
that's
of
what
those
I
things.
always liked about Green Lantern was that he could do whatever he could imagine with his ring. And I didn't really ever stop to think, well, why is his imagination so limited? It was just like, that's a cool concept. And I also like the style of Green Lantern. I like his costume. I like the Gil Kane Silver Age stuff a lot. And so I was attracted to that more than anything. I never actually read that many great Hal Jordan comics. I mean, there was the Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams stuff, but Hal Jordan doesn't come off particularly well in that stuff at all. And then there was the Len Wein, Dave Gibbons run, which is actually where I started reading Green Lantern. So it was around issue 180, somewhere in that range. And those issues look great. I mean, Dave Gibbons was doing fantastic work there. And so I think that was the thing that initially drew me in. But I'd never read that many great Hal Jordan comics. But I always found him a more interesting character than Kyle Rayner, even though Kyle Rayner was fine, even though, yeah, he took a different approach with the ring and he was able to design more intricate stuff. To me, that never seemed like an interesting visual concept in and of itself. It was kind of a one-note thing. Okay, he can design intricate things. He can make a big suit of armor for himself, but that's about it. That's not the point of the character for me. The point of the character is that he's this space guy. He can go off and be this astronaut with superpowers, or he can go off and be this kind of fighter ace guy with superpowers. And I thought that was interesting, that he was a thrill seeker first and foremost who had this ring. But that doesn't appeal to you at all.
When you put it like that, I think it could. Which is sort of the way that when I was talking to Jeff Johns all those years ago, it was between Rebirth and when the series itself launched. And that's sort of the way he was describing it. And I'm like, that sounds like it could be good. And
but
then I read the first couple issues and was like, this is just awful.
Here's a topic that maybe we can actually talk about and then save this bit of podcast and not lose it.
Okay.
And the topic is Captain America 602.
Captain America 602.
I'm going to start with the backup. What do you think about the Nomad backup?
I stopped reading it about halfway through.
Didn't it feel like it didn't belong in this comic at all?
It really did not match up to anything else except for the fact that, Nomad was Bucky and Heroes Reborn.
I read a couple of the issues of the Nomad series, the McKeever series, and I reviewed one of them for CBR, and I thought it was fine. On its own, it was this fun little thing. It almost had a Marvel Adventures kind of light feel to it. Had some jokes, had some action. It was fine, but placed in the back of Captain America, which isn't a super serious, heavy-duty comic, but the tone is so different, it just feels like it's out of place. It almost feels like those HeroScape insert comics that were put in issues like 8 years ago that were like ads for toys. That's what it felt like. It felt like this ad for something else that didn't belong at all.
Yeah, I would have stuck this as like a backup for Amazing Spider-Man, I think. It's much more in that tone of young urban hero trying to be good and kind of lighter and fluffier, like that sort of thing. Like, it seems to match more of a tone of a Spider-Man comic than Captain America currently.
It's a strange choice. I mean, it can't be a selling point for anybody who's like, ooh, Nomad, I'm going to pick up this Captain America comic that I've heard about. Like, so what's the thinking, I wonder, behind it?
Probably they just brought the character back. They liked what Sean McKeever was doing, and they're trying to give it, not being accused of not giving a property a chance to succeed. Of course, this is the one instance of a property that, as far as I can see, it wasn't a critical darling. I didn't see too many fans clamoring for more. It was just an instance of them trying to do that, except with something that nobody actually cared about.
So let's convincingly say that the Nomad backup was not one of the draws of the issue for us. So what did you think about Captain America 602?
Actually, I didn't go as far as to say the Nomad thing, because it also was one of the reasons why the comic is a dollar more than it was before Reborn. It's almost a drawback.
That's true.
In that way that I never really thought about that, like when people were talking about DC doing their co-features.
Yeah.
I never really thought about that because it didn't affect any titles that I was actively buying.
Yeah.
But that was one of those instances where I can kind of see the point of, yeah, this is a book that I really look forward to, and I got to pay more for it for this extra stuff that I not even don't want, but tried to like, and it wasn't good.
Right. And it's
but then
not,
again,
it's not like the Nomad thing is terrible, though. I mean, it's terrible in comparison to the tone of the Captain America story. It's just so out of place that it makes it seem bad. Because I think on its own, it would have worked okay. It would be like a 2.5-star comic. It's fine. But it just seems like a 1-star comic compared to Captain America.
Yeah, and I think what I can just tell myself, too, is that for all I know, without doing the second feature, Marvel would have raised the price anyways.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, they did that to Thor. Now, Thor went back down once Straczynski left, so maybe they might have just thought, well, Reborn was $4. Why not make the regular series $4, too?
Yeah, that. So maybe Nomad is a bonus for free anyway. So you can enjoy it for that, then.
Yeah, I don't think I can.
Oh, well. So I thought it was pretty interesting that Brubaker was ballsy enough to start with this opening scene without telling us it was the 1950s Cap, but right away you're like, wait, why is Captain America doing that? And he's just blowing up cop cars and smashing stuff. I like that he started with that. It's like, Captain America's back, and he's acting like a total dick. And then he's like, oh, well, that's the 50s Cap. Okay.
I think you might have had an indication if you read the solicits or even the recap page.
No, see, I skipped the recap page. I hate recap
pages. I usually skip the recap pages, too, unless it's a comic that I'm reviewing where I hadn't read any previous issues. But if you read the solicits, like, I knew that going in, so I didn't really consider that. But that is a good – that's sort of what he did during the – after Barnes became the new Captain America, and then we saw the Captain America and cryogenics suspension. I remember we discussed that on the splash page, and – we discussed if we cared if it would turn out to be the real Steve Rogers, if we were going to speculate, and we were like, yeah, we'll just wait and see how it turns out. We trust Brubaker.
Yeah, I still trust Brubaker. This is one of
the
thing about Brubaker is I love this. I liked Incognito a lot. I love Criminal. I don't really like, you know, his X-Men run was weak. His Authority stuff was weak. I don't like a lot of his more traditional superhero-y stuff. But he's done such a great job with Captain America. And yeah, Reborn got derailed by the delays and the fact that it just was out of the main series. I think if the plot of Reborn was in the mainline series, I think I would have enjoyed it more. But
yeah,
I felt like this kind of got back on track for me. I was back on the Cap bandwagon after this issue.
I do have to wonder if that's partly because Dean White is doing the coloring and you don't have... Oh, what the hell... Frank D'Armata.
Yeah. I noticed that immediately.
The bane of your existence coloring the book?
I was flipping through it, and I was like, wow, this is not colored by Frank D'Armata. I was like, look back. Yep, sure enough, it's not. All right.
Although I never disliked him as much as you. I don't think he was that great, but I really liked the fact that his visual style really kept the art together the entire run.
I just don't like how overpowering he is. I mean, if you look at Michael Lark's stuff on Captain America versus Michael Lark's stuff on Daredevil, Matt Hollingsworth is able to be subtle enough and still do a lot of flashy, contemporary-looking cinematic colors without overpowering Michael Lark to allow Michael Lark to be the artist that he's supposed to be. But Frank D'Armata just made everything look like his stuff. Like, it was not all that different from what other guys were doing on the series. And to me, I find that annoying. I find that detracts from the artistry of the pencilers and the inkers.
I liked that only because I thought that gave the book a very consistent look. It didn't matter who was penciling it. It still looked like Captain America, the book. And I thought that was a smart move, especially when they started bringing in, even though like Mike Perkins was doing a style very similar to Steve Epting, and so Luke Ross was doing his best to do that style as well, that I thought having that coloring that was so overpowering really added that extra level of consistency that made changing artists not a bad thing.
What about this, though? Do you think that particular approach lends itself well to this Captain America run, whereas, just to compare it again to Spider-Man actually benefits by having a lot of different artistic styles on the book? Do you think that some series have the consistency and they need the consistency and other series would benefit from more experimentation? Or do you think you would like to see that approach applied everywhere?
It depends on the series. I think because Brubaker is, even with little story arcs, he's ultimately telling one big story. You want that visual consistency. You want it to be as consistent front to back as possible. It'd be like if every chapter of a novel suddenly changed font.
Right.
Like you don't do that because you want it to be as easy to maintain that big picture approach. Where Spider-Man, even if they're doing kind of a bigger narrative, it's still very much focused on the smaller story arcs.
So you're like a novel like House of Leaves, where every chapter does change the font and does change the style. That's the equivalent.
Yeah, which you can also do. But in general, if you're telling a big story, you want to maintain it as consistently as possible. At least if your purpose isn't to experiment with form and function as you're going along anyways, which Brubaker isn't trying to do. So he's trying to tell a very consistently paced tone series. So
do you think that that type of artistic change has hurt Bendis with the Avenger stuff?
A little bit. I think what's hurt him is that he's often paired with popular artists who can't tell stories visually to save their lives.
Like Billy Tan?
Like Billy Tan, David Finch.
David Finch, DC, the big fish that DC hooked, David Finch. Can you believe it? So exciting.
Oh, I know. I was doing backflips here, just so excited for DC that they would have another artist to put on books and pair with Grant Morrison, possibly, that I just absolutely hate.
Yeah, except David Finch is going to write his own stuff, too. That's even better. Double dose.
No, that's what they have with Tony Daniel writing and drawing. It's like, that makes it a lot easier for me to just avoid him. I probably should have said some funny stuff there, shouldn't I have, just to give you a little treat later when you listen to it back? But
well,
I totally didn't.
I was not recording when I was gone, so I wouldn't have heard.
You would have been, know if you were recording or not. I thought
you would have been performing for yourself at that point.
Honestly, that's what I'm doing 99% of the time when I'm writing anyways, so.
Oh, yeah, me too. When I'm writing, I just try to entertain myself, and then I send it out into the world. When you write your reviews, is that just like one draft?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't do multiple drafts of pretty much anything, honestly.
Yeah, me neither. That's why this style of writing, this kind of journalistic style of writing of just pumping out a draft, sending it in, I really appreciate that style of writing, because when I get into deep revision, like, I just don't want to deal with it anymore. Like, I've had enough of reading the same paragraph over and over. With the Grant Morrison book, the way Mike Phillips was my editor, and I love Mike Phillips, but his editorial style was always just to ask questions about everything. Like, he would put a note being like, what about this or this, with every paragraph. And so it wasn't like change this, or it wasn't fix this, or it wasn't him going in and rewording stuff or changing punctuation. It was, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And it was endless. And it was so much work to constantly go back and reread a paragraph and revise it. And it really just sucked the life out of me. I could not do it anymore.
Yeah. I've always been one. It's arrogant, but I always thought I had enough natural talent that I could not sort of just do it, especially for reviews and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
But also, this is something I've mentioned when I talk about what stuff I like. I like energy in writing, and I find endless reviews just sort of you Alan Moore to death.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, again, certain people, like, I know Jog rewrites his stuff a lot and does a lot of revisions, and for his style, that works great. But I can't imagine, like, Tucker doing a lot of revisions necessarily.
No, I know what you mean on that. So talking about some of our online friends, we did get a request to talk about certain topics. And I think clearly the number one request was Tony Daniel versus Philip Tan was the number one topic. So if you had to pick one of those two artists and you had to buy a comic by one of them, which would you choose?
I'll say Tony Daniel, only because his stuff with Morrison wasn't as bad as Tan's stuff with Morrison.
Yeah, why was that? I totally agree with that. I didn't hate Tony Daniel. I don't think he's good. I can see his flaws clearly. But Philip Tan, especially after issue five and six of Batman and Robin particularly, were just so terrible. And how would you characterize the difference between the two artists and why Philip Tan is so much worse?
At least Tony Daniel knows how to set up the visual context of a scene. He lets you at least know where things are taking place. Tan really, really, really dropped the ball on that, especially in issue six, where there's supposed to be the big reveal that they're in the back of a truck or a tank or some sort of vehicle that I'm still not 100% certain on what vehicle it was, and there was no clue to that in the art.
Yeah, he really can't. He's not good at establishing a sense of space at all. It's just, it's these images, and his actual figure work can be good. Like, you've seen him do good figure work elsewhere or in sketches or in pinups, but when he's actually drawing panel to panel continuity, it's like the sense of space just gets jammed together, or it gets too murky, or he doesn't actually show what he's supposed to show. Whereas Tony Daniel has a different problem. Tony Daniel makes everything flat. His characters have a flatness, his backgrounds kind of flatten out and go together, and then he'll put in this splash page of a character posing, but the pose is always a little bit awkward. And so that's just kind of annoying. But with Philip Tan, it really is clumsy. It's cumbersome. You can't really follow it. It's really, it's discouraging to read that comic and say, oh, here, this might be a good story, but I have no idea because it's just buried under this mess.
Well, he's also inconsistent, where characters will actually change how they look from panel to panel.
Yeah.
That's like, I noticed that especially this week's issue of Outsiders, where...
Oh, yeah, you reviewed that.
Oh, God. It was just bad, but not in that fun, bad way. I was hoping for fun, bad, and I just got bad. Boring, bad. That's the worst kind of bad, where it's just awful, but you're also so bored by it, you don't even want to, like, discuss how bad it is.
Who was it online who was talking about, you really have to talk, was it Kieran Gillen, I think, was talking about, you have to talk about the artist and the writer together as the creators of the comic, and you, it's ridiculous to separate the two. And I agree with that. I agree with that in theory, but in practice, it's not about the individuals. It's about, you're just, you know, you're giving this person who is attributed as the writer, you're giving him credit for things, even though you know that it's a collaborative medium and you know that it could be editorial influence. It's still, you know, it's kind of a shorthand for an explanation rather than saying the person who was responsible for this decision, you know, instead of just the sloppy, passive way of writing about it, you just, you assign blame or you assign credit to somebody, and it's the person who, whose name is on the comic. And so it's not necessarily accurate, but that's how it is in literary criticism as well. I mean, you have that with the writers, if you're talking about Hemingway, or if you're talking about anybody who worked with Maxwell Perkins. Perkins was notorious for making radical editorial changes and for driving those books, and yet you still give credit to Hemingway, even though he may not have been the one who made that decision.
Yeah, well, Then again, you and I, like, you've studied Morrison's work enough, I've studied Joe Casey's work enough, that we can usually pick out stuff that seems like them compared to anybody else.
Yeah, that's true. So I think maybe it's a level of awareness, but even
well,
so...
Well, I was saying with Giffen and his various co-writers at times, like I said, if we read enough of their stuff, we could probably begin to determine what came from who. It's just, I don't think either one of us wants to devote that much time to any of that.
Yeah, I don't really know the overall DC approach at all right now. The Superman comics are just terrible. Superman in Action are not even worth looking at. The Batman stuff, Batman and Robin, okay, comes out every once in a while, but the other Batman stuff, I don't understand what the point of any of it is. Although, when I dipped into that one Tony Daniel written and drawn issue, I was surprised at how much he packed into it, at least. You know what? It wasn't slowly paced. It wasn't boring. It was like he packed a ton of stuff into that issue, but it just seems to be rambling and doesn't serve any larger purpose. And then, you know, what's going on with Wonder Woman and who cares about that? And does that fit in with anything? It seems like such a classic 1990s Marvel approach to just, here's some stuff and we're throwing this out and here's a spinoff of this and here's that and here's our big event and this is important for this, but then there's all this other stuff. It seems like DC's in that stage of 1990s Marvel, and I don't understand that at all, because Marvel has gotten its act together and knows how to make things coherent and knows how to advertise books, and they sure, they might cancel books that people like that aren't selling that well, but then they take the creators and put them on better selling stuff, and they sort of build this farm team and they make sense out of all of it. It's, I don't understand DC's approach at all.
I don't either, and we get into sort of like our reviewing side of things. Like Marvel sends out PDFs each week, and I've never understood why DC doesn't, especially with stuff like, I mean, where just because if you look at the number of books reviewed, this isn't to mean that like any of the reviewers favor Marvel over DC. It's just if there's a chance to sample an issue without having to pay for it.
Sure. Yeah, you save $4 or whatever.
And even just what we mentioned with the recap pages, again, I'm more inclined to sample a Marvel issue because at least on a basic plot level, there's a recap page there that'll at least give me some context. And DC doesn't do that, and I never understood that at all. It does literally adds no negative value to the comic. It only brings positives. So I never understood that either. Like, those are two big things that it's like, those are two things that, at least on the reviewing level, would at least get your books out there more, and possibly, I mean, you always take the risk of getting bad reviews, but if you stand by your books, you also take the risk of getting a lot more positive reviews and get a lot more buzz around books.
Yeah, and the way Marvel does it is, even if you give a bad review to a Marvel comic, like, they'll still throw your quotes in press releases. They'll just take out the compliment that you put in the bad review, and they'll put it up in the press release. And DC never takes any of the stuff from CBR. I know there's some bad historical bad blood between CBR and DC, but that still doesn't explain why they don't give out PDFs to anybody. Their promotions department is maybe dismissive of the entire comic book, the online comic book journalism approach at all. They just dismiss all the websites. And
well, I've noticed that too, and just in the pull quotes that they use. Yeah, like you've mentioned CBR, I think, because I'll sometimes check out trade paperbacks, at least just to see if my name ever gets mentioned, or a quote of mine, if it's something that I reviewed an issue or two of. And I think technically, I don't know if it was my quote, but I think on like the first unwritten trade, the CBR quote was like fascinating. That could have been me. That could have been you. It could have been one of the other guys.
They just said Comic Book Resources, right? They didn't contribute to the right.
Yeah,
when DC does that, they don't give credit to the writer. Yeah.
I always hate that. At least on that trade, it made sense because they put a lot of quotes on the back. Like, it was just like part of the design. So I can understand wanting to limit the amount of text per thing. That's always been a pet peeve of mine too, when they quote a place and they just quote the site, not the writer.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. Clearly, it's not a hive mind. We said that before. We don't all have exactly the same approach. And
No. And that's not meant to be a negative against anybody else. It's just, it's not, why would you want six guys who all have the same approach?
Exactly.
That's not a good way to have a reviewing staff. If you're going to have six people, you might as well have six individuals, not six of the same person.
Yeah.
Between the site and DC again, who cares? You're only hurting yourself, DC.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know exactly what went on, but I know that Rich Johnson definitely had a lot of enemies. The things that Rich Johnson spoiled about upcoming events or about characters, I mean, about creators' lives or careers.
Yeah.
That really caused some friction. And I don't know. To me, it always seemed like no matter what Rich did, it would always raise interest in that project. So
yes.
I never understood why people saw it as such a negative. Because if I saw something on Lying in the Gutters, I would be more inclined to find out more about that project. It wouldn't make me, even if it was something that was kind of spoiler related, it would never make me say, oh, I'm not buying that because Rich Johnson spoiled it. I don't understand that approach at all.
Me neither. But also, I don't think he was ever like crueler or harsher to DC than Marvel or any other company.
No.
He treated it all as equal. So again, if your competition isn't penalizing that site for that reason, then why are you?
Yeah.
That just, again, seems very not professional. It's something that happens in wrestling a bit. I don't know if you've ever noticed where, do you watch it as that much with your son still?
I just watch a little bit. And the thing is, one of the things that in your ongoing conversation with him on the splash page, you mentioned that you didn't think he was watching wrestling that far back, because he wasn't. But my brother is a huge wrestling fan, and so my brother has shown Andrew various DVDs of like matches in the past.
Yeah, that's what I assumed after he mentioned he saw it.
Yeah, so like I have seen stuff, you know, for a long time, because my brother's always been a huge fan.
But I mean, like, for a while there, MVP was getting buried, possibly because he pissed someone off backstage, and they're kind of doing the same thing with Jack Swagger, and people assume it's because he did something wrong backstage, and it's like, why are you punishing him publicly like that? It's not entertaining, and you're just creating a worse product.
Right.
And it's one of those things where you just see these people, I think that's what DC does, where they're letting personal things get in the way of business. And it's not beneficial. You're just shooting yourself in the foot over stupid pride-related things. And as was said in Pulp Fiction, pride never helps. It only hurts. If it really just comes down to Johnston, then look at the other companies that seem to have no problem. And question if you're really helping yourself out or you're just standing by stupid pride.
Yeah, and usually I don't care at all about the intra-company dynamic or what's going on behind the scenes, really. I mean, it sometimes could be interesting in a gossipy level, but I don't care at all, other than the fact of it's causing some crappy comics to come out. And I want my comics to be good, and so if whatever that stuff can go away, or if they can solve those problems and it creates more interesting reading material, then I'm all for it.
Yeah. I like to turn this instance if only because it possibly hurts the job we have to do.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it would be nice to be able to get some PDFs of the DC comics and to sample other things, because that's happened even with the Hulk comic. The Hulk comic is not a very good comic, but every once in a while when I sample a PDF, I really find it entertaining. You know, it's something that I would never have picked up off the shelf, but by giving me that sample of it, and I see what they're doing, and I see Ed McGuinness's art, and I become attracted to it as a product that I would never, ever buy. But maybe after I sample it, I'll check it out. I have gone with a sample PDF, and then I've gone to pick up the comics because it was enticing. And DC doesn't even offer us that. And so it's much, you know, draws less attention to the line.
Yeah, and I mean, I know I take advantage of the free PDFs, at least from non-Marvel companies, I think a bit more than anybody else. Because also, like, I like the fact that they have the free PDFs, and I'm much more willing to just go, okay, I'll read you this. It's a little teaser. They're basically telling me they're trying to facilitate the reviews. They recognize, like, it just seems like a sign of respect almost, and I appreciate that. So, like, look at the number of reviews from Top Cow, Dynamite, Boom, various companies that try to be as reviewer friendly as possible. Radical, like a lot of these, again, the smaller press companies that recognize the importance of getting their name out there, and that a bad review isn't necessarily that bad, if only because, unless your book is so horrible that the reviewer has nothing positive to say, it could just be they didn't like it, but at a rate, they'll raise plot points or ideas about the comic, and the review that a person may go, well, I don't think that the guy's approaching that correctly, but I want to give that a shot because that sounds interesting to me.
I think some of these companies, like, I mean, specifically DC, but maybe some of the other companies as well, specifically ignore the online review sites because they think that it doesn't matter. Because it really doesn't, in the sense of, by the time we review Blackest Night Phantom Stranger, the retailers have already placed their orders, and there's nothing that our reviews can do to make them order more or order less. Like, it's too late, by the way the direct market is set up. So keeping that in mind, do you think that reviews ultimately have any effect on sales, short-term or long-term, at all?
I think they have an effect. Whether or not that effect is large enough, I can't say for sure. But, I mean, especially for ongoing series, I'm sure you've had people say this to you. I've had a few people say this to me, where they'll say that they read my reviews and are influenced by what I think of books. It may not be a lot of people, like, I can't say for sure how many people ultimately, I don't know even how many people read any of our reviews. But I mean, if I've even had four people say that they actually read my reviews and are somewhat influenced by them, I mean, that's something to consider, because you don't know how many people just never mention that or do it a bit more casually. But especially for ongoing series or series that depend on traits a bit more, I think that the online reviews matter. Although I think that they tend to just ignore the comic book, the comic site's online reviews. They seem very eager to promote any online-only reviews from the so-called mainstream media.
Right.
Which I understand and also don't understand at the same time, only in the sense that I know that if I see a quote about something like, let's say, a detective crime fiction book, say there's a quote from Entertainment Weekly and then a quote from something that's obviously something that focuses on detective crime fiction, I'm going to give more weight to the person who actually focuses on that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm the same way too. And so I don't really know, other than the fact that the sort of general audience might take a quote from Entertainment Weekly as having more value than a quote from a online site.
But then again, I mean, like, if you look at the names Entertainment Weekly or, like, and it's a comic book resources, you may, I don't know how everybody thinks, but I know that I might see the fact that they're both comic books and a site devoted to the comic books, that that reviewer may have a better grasp of things. But then again, the other reviewer may represent the average person more. So again, like, I can see positive and negatives to each, but I think favoring one over the other inherently may not be the right approach always.
And I don't approach reviews like, oh, I hope I help the sales or I hope I hurt the sales of this book. Like, that's not,
of course not.
That's not at all even in the back of my mind. But it does strike me that when I read, like, certainly you've sold me on a bunch of Joe Casey comics, like comics I would not have bought if you didn't talk about Joe Casey so much. So there's that. But I think, you know, something like Scalped, like, by the way, I've been talking about Scalped for such a long time that I know I have attracted people to Scalped and then they have told other people about Scalped. So it does have that long-term reaction, and it might not be a reaction to a specific issue. It might not be that Scalped number 12 sold better or worse because of a review, but maybe Scalped 30 sold better or worse because of the review of Scalp number 12. I think there's that chain reaction effect that's hard to see because we don't really know exactly how many readers we get. And the vast majority of readers we get don't know our names. They just think of the CBR review. And so we don't really know how much of an impact those reviews have. But I can't help but think that those reviews have some sort of reaction down the line.
Yeah, and I know I've had that with Young Liars specifically, where a lot of people have mentioned that me talking it up on CBR and comics should be good made them give it a look. Now, granted, the title's been canceled, but that may still help DC sell trades.
And it might help when, you know, Lapham does his, I don't know, is it pronounced Lapham or Lapham? I don't know.
I don't know.
When Lapham does his next project, or, you know, when he's doing his next Vertigo series or whatever he ends up working on, it might bring some more eyeballs to it, because I think that's what happened with someone like Matt Fraction. You know, The Order got some positive buzz, and then there were some more eyeballs on his stuff after that. And The Order got some positive buzz because of Casanova and people talking about Casanova online. I certainly wouldn't have read Casanova if it wasn't for Dr. Clock's stuff on Casanova. That I wasn't aware of Casanova from issue one. I started reading it because Jeff Clock was writing about it so much.
Really? I was reading, I think, but I knew about Fraction before Casanova.
I knew about Fraction before Casanova, too, but I didn't even see Casanova because my shop didn't get it.
Oh, okay. I knew about it. I knew that it was coming partly because I followed Fraction from Pipeline and then his other comic work, and then it was also advertised. And he talked about it on the Basement Tapes with Casey when they were doing that column. It also was advertised in Fell,
so
I had an idea
right
that
there.
It,
yeah.
I knew it was coming and had a good idea. But yeah, like, it's hard to tell how much of an actual impact you have, but I think ultimately, I think this is definitely true. I know probably us talking up books have probably helped sales more than us talking down books have hurt it.
Yeah.
I think it's far more inclined, it's more likely that us saying something repeatedly is good is going to get people to check it out than us just saying one issue of it is bad than is going to get people to not check it out.
Yeah, and I think most online reviewers enjoy talking about books that they like to read and would rather promote those and get more readers on board. You know, there might be a pleasure in really tearing into something, but
Oh, yes.
I don't, that's never the goal, but it's always better to review something that's really good or really bad. Reviewing those mediocre things are hard to write about.
That's what I said to, I think, David Brothers recently when we were talking about something and then talking about reviewing. And I'm saying, he mentioned something about how I'm a decent reviewer or something like that. And I said, the best way to actually get better is to constantly, week in, week out, write about one or two utterly mediocre books with which you have nothing to say. Where, like, you read it and you go, I have no idea what I'm going to say about this book. It's not good. It's not bad. There's nothing really to talk about. And suddenly you're forced to write 500 words on it.
One of the things that I like about the Sentry, I don't like the Sentry very much.
Really?
I liked the Jay Lee art on the original series, but I don't find the Sentry particularly interesting as a character at all. But I do like the approach that Bendis is finally emphasizing, and yeah, as you said, it's kind of been there since the beginning. But this idea that it's not that the Sentry is this screwed up character who can kind of hold it together and then kind of like goes off and runs away, but that the Sentry is just this completely screwed up addict who's got almost no redeeming qualities. And the few moments when he does pretend to be a hero, like even then he's faking it completely.
Yeah.
And so it's not that there's this 50-50 of, oh, here's this really great heroic guy, and then, oh, he's got this Jekyll and Hyde side to his personality where he's this crazy guy. It's that he's totally screwed up and he can't hold it together ever.
See, I've always liked the Sentry, mainly because I thought those elements were always kind of there. Like, even when I was re I remember I don't know if I knew that the Sentry was the Void before I read the trade, because I got the trade after the whole thing.
Right.
But even when I was reading the story, I'm like, okay, that's obviously what's going to happen. And I thought that was interesting. And I like the fact that he was screwed up. I think Mark Waid's doing a similar thing on Irredeemable with the Plutonian, that I think
Yeah.
is, that was one of those ones that I think I mentioned this word, the longer that series has gone, the better it's been. Only because it went from being that Superman is evil to suddenly, wait, no, this guy was always screwed up and just not. And it's one of those things that I was, Mark Waid's always talked about with Flies to the Sentry and the Plutonian. Like, how are all these people who randomly get superpowers mentally equipped to be heroes?
Right. Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things that I think Waid has done better than the Sentry stuff has done, just in the sense of society really likes to build people up and then tear them down just for the fun of it.
And on that happy note, we'll wrap it up for the week. Join us next week, maybe, when we talk about more stuff.